This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. Women in the U.S. have been constitutionally guaranteed the right to an abortion since Roe v. Wade in 1973. And long before that, Americans were also guaranteed the right to free speech. At abortion clinics around the country, the clash of these two rights is coming to a head. In Kentucky, a standoff between abortion rights and anti-abortion activists is playing out on the sidewalks surrounding the state's last abortion clinic. But here in North Carolina, a Charlotte clinic is also at the center of a similar fight. Clinic workers say the protests have become so heated, they're affecting the safety of patients and employees. A new documentary by news outlet Rewire looks at the battle. It's called Care in Chaos. Calla Hales is featured in the documentary. She's the director of a preferred women's health center, which operates abortion clinics in Charlotte and Raleigh, along with two others in Georgia. And Calla joins me live now on the program. Calla, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. So I know that you grew up in a family that worked in women's health care and provided abortion access, and your parents actually founded the first preferred women's health center in Raleigh. Tell us a bit about what drove them to do that.
It was very clear that abortion access was something that was needed in the South, particularly. We've had family interactions in the past about just the lack of pure access there was. My mother grew up in South Carolina, in rural South Carolina, and there wasn't a place to go for that type of care. When I grew up with older sisters especially, my parents really drove in that point that women should have the right to govern their own bodies.
So what did the conversations look like around your dinner table? Obviously, a number of individuals morally oppose the kind of work that these clinics do on a day-to-day basis. How did you all discuss that as a family?
Very openly and honestly. I understood from a young age exactly what vacuum aspiration was and the ideas behind termination procedures and what abortion rights were and how that extends into the greater picture of reproductive justice. We're not necessarily fighting for abortion rights for everyone. We're fighting for everyone to have the right to have a choice about an abortion. And we understand that it's not the right decision for everyone.
So why did you decide to follow in your parents' path? There are a number of, obviously, career options you could have chosen. Why this one?
I went to college in New York, and it was quite a liberal turnaround from growing up in the South, where you really don't actively talk about politics or about bodily autonomy. That's not really a conversation starter you have in high school in the South. When I went to college, it was very clear that I was in a bubble, and a very sheltered bubble that was conservative in these types of rights, and I realized how much of an impact just the ability of education and being able to talk about these rights really meant.
So you spent time away. You moved back to North Carolina, where you're now the director of a preferred women's health center that operates four clinics, I think two in North Carolina, one in Charlotte, one in Raleigh. Can you tell us more about the clinic itself? What does it look like? What kind of services do you offer?
I mean, we look like any other healthcare facility. It's not like we have a massive sign in the front that says abortions are performed here. It's just like any other healthcare facility. We specialize particularly in abortion care. We do refer out to for other continuing services for pro-choice adoption agencies, for continuing care, or even for contraception care.
And who are the kind of clients that walk through your doors?
Any woman or even any person could be a patient at our clinic. There is no stereotype. Every person comes in that door with a different story.
So can you give us a sense of what the clinic looks like on an average day or on an average weekend, I guess more so, because there are some protests that are happening in front of your clinic that have really heated up?
The Charlotte clinic particularly is kind of become this hotbed of protester activity. During the week, we typically see between 15 to 30 people outside, as well as two mobile RV buses that perform ultrasounds. Those are sponsored by crisis pregnancy centers in the state. On the weekends, it does get a little out of hand. We typically see anywhere between 100 to 200 protesters on the standard Saturday, as well as those buses. There are prayer marches that walk around the street. There's an active amount of children that are running around. It's chaotic, to say the least. And that's not to mention the Saturdays where there are specially planned events. Previously, so far this year, we've had a 1,000 manned march on the clinic. We also had a 5,000 person march on the clinic in December.
So there's obviously a lot of chaos, a lot of moving parts and moving bodies. Are you concerned for the safety of your patients? Can you describe why you feel concerned?
My concern is for staff and patients being able to get to the clinic. I always have to reiterate that the chaos outside doesn't impact our level of care. It doesn't impact my ability to do my job or our staff's ability to do their job. Unfortunately, it's getting into the driveway. That's the hard part. And it really is a traffic issue. There are people walking in front of cars and flagging drivers down, whether they're my patients or not. They could be attending other businesses nearby. There are serious issues with sight lines, with signage. It's a little chaotic. It's definitely dangerous. And I'm hoping that people are really starting to understand what the problems are with this.
I know you also fear for your own safety. You actually recently shared your story with a number of media outlets, including Cosmopolitan Magazine, and you described an experience of being sexually assaulted outside of a bar in Raleigh. You were working at an abortion clinic in Raleigh at that time. Can you tell us more about that?
I don't know how comfortable I am really going into the sensitive details of the attack on air, especially live. But I would say that, you know, if people are interested in the details, they can read the Cosmopolitan article. That is an article that had a lot of access to my medical records and my staff, my life, all of my records as a whole. So I really do stand by that article and the truth of it. I can say that, yes, my safety is a concern. The pushback we've gotten from that article has been pretty harsh. I may have been naive about underestimating how much pushback we were going to get. But I'm not letting it stop me from doing my job.
And our listeners can find a link to the article that Cal is referencing at our website, stateofthings.org. And in that article, you do connect your experience of sexual assault to the work that you do at the clinic. Can you describe that connection?
Yes. It was very clear to me that it was a targeted attack because of my job, due to some of the language that was used during and after the attack. Calling me a Jezebel, telling me I deserved it because I was a murderer and killed babies. 2 years later, it's a little easier to talk about because I hear the same language every day. Mm-hmm. I'm called a murderer every day. I'm told that I am Satan's little helper, that I'm going to hell. It can just continue on how horrible some of the language is.
You didn't end up pressing charges. Why did you make that decision?
For a lot of different reasons. One was the fact that in a lot of sexual assault cases, it's not successful. It's not a successful trial. It becomes he said, she said, and the victim blaming in this country is out of control. Even within the first 2 or 3 days after my attack, talking to friends, some of the first questions I got was, well, were you drunk? Were you asking for it? And that's not the type of conversation that anyone should have to handle, let alone one on such a drastic level. I didn't feel that I could safely survive a trial.
I know the assault prompted you to move to Charlotte, and you even describe in the article that it sort of changed how you dress, how you present yourself. You wear something different every day so as to not be identified. Can you describe that a bit more to us?
Sure. I do take care to make sure that I'm not necessarily drawing attention to myself when I'm coming into places, or that I'm not easily, I guess, found in a crowd, I should say. I try really hard not to just stick out. It's interesting because there's been a lot of commentary about that, of why would I do media but not want to be, recognized. And the issue, or I guess the conversation with that, is there's a happy medium. I'm not running around trying to find attention on every given day, and that's not something I want to do, but this topic needs to be spoken about. And, you know, if it means some of my personal privacy has to be the, I guess, victim of this, I will accept that.
We're going to continue to talk about your story and your experience at the clinic and how it's part of a bigger picture of what's happening around the country as our conversation continues. I've been speaking with Calla Hales. She's the director of a preferred women's health center, which operates abortion clinics in Charlotte and Raleigh, along with two others in Georgia. We're going to continue our conversation just ahead with a filmmaker who's been documenting some protests at abortion clinics. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. Today, we're taking a look at tensions surrounding abortion clinics in the United States. A new documentary called Care in Chaos focuses on the heated protests at abortion clinic in Charlotte. It's by the reproductive rights news outlet Rewire. I'm speaking with Calla Hales, who's the director of a preferred women's health center that runs abortion clinics in Charlotte and Raleigh, along with two others in Georgia. And joining me now is Lindsay Beierstein. She is an investigative journalist and the director of the documentary Care in Chaos. Lindsay, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Anita.
Thanks for being here. So I know you've been studying this anti-abortion movement for years. Tell us a bit about why you decided to focus this documentary on a clinic in Charlotte and a clinic in Fargo, North Dakota.
We're living in an era of increased militancy with anti-choice protesters in general, and what I wanted to do as a filmmaker was to find a contrast between two clinics that had a heavy protester presence, one of which was making it work, where people could both express their First Amendment rights and access health care in a dignified way, and to contrast that with a clinic where that balance wasn't being struck, where the protesters were being overweening and domineering and generally out of control, and to try and analyze which factors contributed to the success in one place and the challenges in the other. And one thing that we discovered was that the relationship between the clinic and the local police is critical.
So we'll get more into that relationship in a minute, but first I want to take a step back and help our listeners understand, what are the laws around a person's right to obtain a reproductive health services in terms of their access to a clinic? I know there's been some legislation trying to mitigate the tension outside of these clinics.
Well, the biggest federal law that protects people's access to abortion clinics is called the FACE Act, or the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. And that prohibits anyone from physically interfering with people trying to walk into the clinic. It prevents them from barring the doors or anything like that, handcuffing themselves to clinic fixtures. This was something that actually happened in the 90s before Bill Clinton signed this bill into law, that there were massive civil disobediences outside of abortion clinics all around the country. And the law in general is that people are allowed to go out and protest in public, on the public right of way, as long as they stay out of the street, as long as they respect local ordinances like noise control and that kind of stuff. People are allowed to have signs, but there are laws that apply to the kind of signs that they have. For instance, you may not be allowed to prop your sign up on an easel. You might have to carry it, stuff like that. It's basically just sort of safety and traffic flow. If you talk to police officers, and we interviewed many, the number one thing that they're concerned about is preventing blockages, making sure that people are not obstructing or menacing or in any way getting into the physical space of the patients or the escorts or any of the counter protesters. They want to keep people safe out there if they can, but it's often a challenge. Emotions can get really high.
Of course, yeah, and you show that in the documentary, and there is a lot of gray area and questions about what constitutes obstruction or interference. You describe in the film scenes of protesters sort of intercepting cars, and I know you experienced that yourself. Can you describe that to us?
Yes. When we first drove up to a preferred women's, somebody stepped in front of our car and our executive producer had to slam on the brakes. And we discovered that this wasn't just a one-off. This was a common thing. And we filmed and put in the documentary many scenes of people wandering out into the street, people sticking their hands through open windows with literature, people obstructing cars to try and enter into a dialogue with the patient or the people with them. And it's really unsafe. I'm really concerned that somebody is going to get hit by a car.
So at these clinics, a number of people have set up these volunteer escort programs that help women get into the clinic safely. And you talk about these in the film. We're going to listen to a quick clip and then we'll talk some more.
There are women who travel to come and exercise their legal rights only to meet oppression, hateful speech, slurs, yelling, very rude individuals stopping their cars.
They'll just talk to you forever.
Don't stop. We are pro-choice volunteers that are trained to escort our patients into the parking lot, and then we physically and emotionally support them as they walk from their cars into the front door.
So that's a clip from the documentary Care in Chaos, and you just heard the voices of two volunteer escorts. I'm here with Calla Hales, the director of a Preferred Women's Health Center, and Lindsay Beierstein, the director of the film. So Calla, tell us about this volunteer escort program and how exactly that works.
We've been really lucky to have a volunteer program called Pro-Choice Charlotte here in our Charlotte office, where there are two technical branches of it. There's the clinic escort side, which are individuals in bright pink or brightly colored vests that will work to kind of block your patients from the protesters and help them just get into the clinic with as little fanfare as possible. We also have a clinic defense group who specifically works to guide traffic into the right driveway and kind of counter some of the misleading signs with protesters. We're pretty lucky that this group is very active with the clinic, and we work together to kind of make sure that patients are as respected as possible and try just to realize that the patients at the end of the day are our utmost priority. That we're not necessarily a battleground for someone's opinion. At the end of the day, we're all here to support patients.
So we've described sort of a number of the individuals that are part of the scene around this clinic. We have the protesters, the anti-abortion protesters, the pro-abortion rights protesters. Then we have law enforcement, local law enforcement. Tell me a bit about their role, Lindsay, and how what that looks in Charlotte in particular.
The police get called out in Charlotte sometimes multiple times a day over noise violations, that the anti-choicers will often obtain an amplified sound permit and show up with a big public address system and microphone and get on the mic and start yelling about, you know, the hidden benefits of having your rapist baby or how God hates you and your offspring or themes like that. And the law says that they're allowed to do that with the permit as long as they're not going over 75 decibels. But as the clinic has discovered through its trained volunteers, they've given them little decibel meter software on their iPhones. They're regularly going over that, sometimes by a lot, and it's kind of overwhelming. It was one thing that we focused a lot on the movie is the experience of being under constant audio bombardment. You know, up to 6 days a week, they apply for the permit every day, and they get it about 80% of the time. And the police come out and they try, it's because of the way the geography is, they can't take an unobserved reading if they just roll up on the speakers. So the protesters can always see the police coming and turn them down. And I gather that recently the police officers have started showing up and hanging around the speakers a little bit more, which I think is a positive development. But they do come out multiple times a day, every week in Charlotte, but they don't really seem to do very much, that they're really pretty disengaged, and it's been difficult getting them to actually police the real traffic violations and noise violations that are clearly going on.
I should say here that we did reach out to the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Law Enforcement to request an interview from the police department, but we did not get a response at the time of this interview. We're talking about the new documentary Care in Chaos that looks at a clinic in Charlotte as well as a clinic in Fargo, North Dakota. And Lindsay, in the film, you document that this Red River abortion clinic actually has a good working relationship with police. Both sides feel more heard around this clinic. Tell me more.
That's correct. The Red River Women's Clinic, it wasn't always so rosy. That there was a time several years ago when the protesters were every bit as aggressive and out of control as we're seeing in Charlotte. But the director of that clinic reached out to the police chief at the time in Fargo, who was interested in all kinds of community policing initiatives. And he was really instrumental in training and supporting a local officer, our local officers in general, and the particular one that we profiled in the film is Officer Jessica White, who's the downtown resource officer, and she's responsible for looking after the downtown in general, the business owners, nightlife participants, LGBT, homeless. So she has links all over the community. She basically knows everyone. It's kind of neat to watch her walking her beat because she's greeting everyone she sees by name sometimes. And she's responsible for keeping the sidewalk clear. That's her big thing, because the geography of that clinic, it's located on the downtown thoroughfare in Fargo, which is very, very dense and very narrow sidewalk. And the protesters could easily obstruct the sidewalk even without meaning to, because the sidewalk is so narrow. So she's really focused on keeping that walkway clear and making sure people don't have signs that are obtrusive or blocking in any way. And she's very available. She makes sure that both the protesters and the clinic can get a hold of her, can talk to her, can raise questions. She's happy to explain what's legal and what's not. In the documentary, she talks about how she dove into the city sign ordinance so that she could figure out exactly which signs were okay and which ones weren't, and did the work to educate the protesters, who appreciate her involvement too. So I think it's kind of a best case scenario that she's able to know people and be proactive, and at the same time people have the freedom to speak their piece outside the clinic, and the escorts and the patients can get through and make sure that everybody is safe and minimally respected in their time of need to get into a healthcare facility.
So one of the things she brings up in the documentary is that it is tricky to make people feel heard on both sides. There's obviously a right to free speech, and protesters can express themselves. But I wonder, Calla, for you, you obviously acknowledge these protesters' right to free speech. What would a safe protest space look like for you that would sort of respect both sides?
I would say a protest that's still acknowledging the local ordinances and following them. I'm someone who is involved in a lot of community protests and a community outreach and activism here in Charlotte. And I've seen these situations where free speech is being heard, but ordinances are still being followed. It is possible. I would love it if, you know, kids weren't running in the street in front of cars, in front of patients. And that the noise levels were being monitored continuously and enforced. I feel that that's one of the biggest issues here in Charlotte particularly, is there's a lot of gray area on enforcement for ordinances. And you get a lot of different answers when you deal with different police officers. So it's a very unclear situation across the board.
We're going to continue our conversation now and bring in one more guest. So this is obviously happening within a bigger context. There are protests happening at clinics around the country. And in the past decade, states have enacted hundreds of new abortion laws. These restrictions have forced many clinics to close and increase tension at the clinics that remain. Joining us now is Carissa Haugeberg. She has studied the history of the anti-abortion movement, and her new book is called Women Against Abortion, Inside the Largest Moral Reform Movement of the 20th Century. She's a professor of history at Tulane University, and she joins me now. Welcome, Carissa.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So in your book, you take a step back to the very beginning of this conversation of the tension between anti-abortion and abortion rights. Tell us where it all began.
The anti-abortion movement began the moment that individual states began to liberalize their abortion laws. So it began in the late 1960s. We really see the types of protests that are underway right now in Charlotte and at clinics nationwide, that really started in the 1970s as clinics began to move out of hospitals, or as abortion providers moved out of hospitals into standalone abortion clinics. Initially, this was lauded by feminists as a new model of healthcare provision. But the unintended consequence is that it made these buildings very uniquely vulnerable to protest. So that's why we'll see protests occurring at abortion clinics, but not, for example, at a dermatologist clinic. Some wonder if abortion providers were tethered to hospitals or to other types of providers, whether we would see the type of violence that we do today.
So the Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade obviously played a big part in how this movement evolved and how the various factions sort of mobilized afterward. Can you tell us a bit about the significance of that decision?
Certainly. So we definitely see the anti-abortion movement mobilize and coordinate nationally after 1973. So before 1973, it was more of a piecemeal operation. We saw individual or small groups form in individual states. And after 1973, it definitely became a nationwide movement. And then through the mid-1980s, a series of Supreme Court decisions protected the rights of women who sought to enter clinics. And this created a lot of tension within the anti-abortion movement. Some people perceived that they were seeing failure after failure after Roe v. Wade. and thought that they needed to do more radical action in order to fight abortion. So we see different factions form within the anti-abortion movement, with some adopting more radical, aggressive strategies in opposition to groups that were focused on legislative strategies. Most famously, the National Right to Life Committee is the more suit and tie branch of the anti-abortion movement. But we start to see these more radical groups like Operation Rescue, Lambs of Christ, and Pro-Life Action Network form in response to what they perceive to be the conservative approach of the National Right to Life Committee.
And some of these strategies actually come from protest tactics used in the Vietnam War. Tell us about that connection.
Absolutely. So many of the first anti-abortion activists were Catholic, and a lot of them identified as Democrats. Many had been involved in civil rights activism, and many, many more had been involved in anti-Vietnam War protests. And one classic example of a strategy that they borrowed from anti-war activism were the posters depicting babies in Vietnam who'd been exposed to Agent Orange. If you look at contemporary anti-abortion propaganda, a lot of it is very similar. That was such an effective strategy during the Vietnam War for getting the American public to have to reckon with the violence and the gruesomeness of strategies used in the Vietnam War. So they are seeking to adopt a similar strategy with abortion. And a number of scholars have analyzed that propaganda and have demonstrated that those images have been manipulated through technology, through the use of food dye. So I just want to make it clear that the gruesome images that you often see outside of these clinics rarely ever depict an actual aborted fetus.
So I know there's been a number of other significant federal and state legislation since Roe v. Wade, and we've spoken earlier about the hundreds of new state laws. Can you tell us more about this and how on a state-by-state level these protests are unfolding sort of in conjunction with this increase in state legislation?
Absolutely. So what we're seeing right now in places like Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, Mississippi, and elsewhere are both familiar to historians and new. So the element that's familiar is that we've seen these mass demonstrations in the past. 20 years ago, Operation Rescue was getting headlines nationwide for these mass protests. During the 1980s and 1990s, over 60,000 Operation Rescue protesters were arrested. So that's just the number who were arrested, not even protesting. They frequently had mass demonstrations where over 5,000 would be arrested at a time. So this is an old technique. We've seen this before. But what's new are these regulations that you mentioned. They're regarded as trap laws, the targeted regulations of abortion providers. And many of your listeners may be familiar with the recent Supreme Court decision, Whole Women's Health. And that basically challenged a couple of trap laws in the state of Texas. So these are the types of laws that require abortion providers to have admitting privileges at a local hospital, or require abortion providers to abide by surgical ambulatory standards. So basically, it's an attempt to regulate abortion out of existence. It's to have all of these medically unnecessary requirements. And so, in a sense, the anti-abortion movement has succeeded by having this multi-pronged approach. Not only do they seek to persuade women through sidewalk counseling or intimidate providers out of being able to enter their workplace, but then, on the other hand, legislators are effectively making it almost impossible for abortion providers to remain open.
I have only about 30 seconds left, but Lindsay, I want to finish with you. You've studied the scenes at both of these abortion clinics around the country. You've heard the testimonies of people on both sides. What do you propose moving forward as a way to make sure more people feel heard and the individuals feel safe?
The first thing I would say is better training for the police officers. I saw over and over again in Charlotte that the police officers were giving conflicting stories. They didn't seem to understand the ordinances themselves. I think also just making this a strategic priority of the department, understanding that there's a really combustible situation out there and that people may very well get hurt. This isn't just petty. It sounds kind of petty to be obsessed with sound permits and decibel meters and stuff like that. But ultimately, what we're talking about is the safety of people at a healthcare facility, not just the patients and the providers, but the protesters themselves. It's really, as I said, combustible out there, and the police department needs to take that seriously and be proactive. And finally, the importance of relationship building, that they need to be willing to reach out to both sides and understand what's going on so that both sides can communicate with them, express their concerns, and make sure that everybody's rights are being respected.
We're going to have to end it there. That's Lindsay Beierstein, an investigative journalist and the director of the new documentary Care in Chaos. I was speaking with Carissa Haugeberg, a professor of history at Tulane University in New Orleans, with a new book, Women Against Abortion, Inside the Largest Moral Reform Movement of the 20th Century, and Calla Hales, the director of Preferred Women's Health Center, which operates 4 abortion clinics across North Carolina and Georgia. Thank you all for joining us.